point to say, could you speak on that on Sunday? And I suppose it's either a captivating title, Behold He Cometh. And there are a lot of scripture verses in there, but of course the immediate thing I wanted to know was, well, who puts these out? Now, I guess everybody around here got them, seeing they were an insert in the with your mail or the newspaper. But it wasn't long before I realised who it was. On the back page, there's a quote. And in fact, this is free book, World Crisis Foretold in 1903, E.G. White, a humble Christian writer. Now, you're probably wondering, well, who in the world is that? And then right beside it, it's got a quote from a book called The Great Controversy. Well, that is the book, The Great Controversy. E.G. White is, her name is Ellen White, and she's actually the founder of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, that's a real old copy, that's about 1888. That's a more modern one. They still reprint it, little paperback thing. So that's the origin of that little leaflet there. But what struck me was a little section that's in a box there. And I'll just read out a little part of it, not all of it, but just a few lines. This booklet conveys the message that the world, and especially Christendom, will soon face the universal decree that will require you to cease labour on Sunday, first day of the week, and to worship on this papal unbiblical day. If you do, you will receive the dreaded seal, the mark of the beast, in your forehead. However, if you will worship on the seventh day, the Sabbath or Saturday, instead, a memorial of God's creative power as described in the fourth commandment, you will receive the coveted seal of God in your forehead and get to spend eternity with him. So I guess you can see where they're coming from. We're worshipping on the wrong day. We should be worshipping on Saturday. But there's different views of this mark of the beast. What is it? Now, of course, he's given a number there in our reading. We saw it's the number of man, 666. Now, I've just given you that one, which says that the mark of the beast is those who worship on, don't worship on a Saturday. You worship on the Sunday, which they say or claim. The change was instituted by one of the early popes. He was the one that changed the day. But when you start to look around and study it a bit, you discover that there's a lot of other views of what this 666 is. Here's one I got given years ago, Coming World Events Unveiled, a study of the Book of Revelation. And in it there's a picture of Adolf Hitler, somewhere or other. And they've worked out, it's called the mystery of 666, and they do it all through numbers, and of course Hitler adds up to be 666. Now, when I was a very young Christian, I was intrigued by a lot of this stuff and started to study it. And one study, which I've even kept the notes, believe it or not, from whenever it was, 40 years ago or something, and I got into this, and one interpretation was that if you add up, or the Latin title for the Pope is Vicarius Filii Dei. Now, if you add that up using Roman numerals, it can add up to be 666. I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? Not that it makes Catholics very happy. But, of course, there's many other views. A few years ago I picked up a little leaflet, or booklet rather, called The Beast, based on this chapter. And this one interprets this mark as a literal mark. And it's got pictures there, if you see it, of everybody's got 666 stamped on their forehead. I don't know whether it's tattooed or burnt on there. But they all get a literal mark on their forehead. Another view is that it's of the Antichrist that is to come in the future. So now that I've thoroughly confused you and given you about four or five different views, what is the meaning of this mark, 666? Well, looking at the first view that I presented there, the Seventh-day Adventist teaching, that's quite an amazing statement, which means that they would hold that anybody that's not worshipping on the Sabbath day will receive one day the mark of the beast. That's the sign of it. Now, that was their original belief, but do they still believe that? Well, it so happens that I have one of their modern day beliefs, or books rather, called Seventh-day Adventists Believe. And this is what it says. When this issue is clearly brought before the world, those who reject God's memorial of creatorship, the Bible Sabbath, choosing to worship and honour Sunday in the full knowledge that it is not God's appointed day of worship, will receive the mark of the beast. This mark is a mark of rebellion. The beast claims its change of the day of worship shows its authority even over God's law. So what does that say? They still believe it. That's still their belief. So if we worship on Sunday, one day we will receive the mark of the beast. Now, what, of course, do the scriptures say? Did the Pope change the day? Why do Christians worship, or the majority of them, on Sunday? Was the day changed? After all, that is the fourth commandment. You shall worship on the Sabbath day. And so there it is. Was that ever changed? Now, doing a quick study, this is not the main part of the message, but just a quick little change. And listen to these verses. John 20, verse 19. On the evening of the first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." That, of course, was the resurrection day. And that was one of the first instances where Jesus met with his disciples, and it was on the first day of the week. Then we go to the book of Acts, chapter 20, verse 7. And Paul writes here, no, Luke's writing about Paul's ministry. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, he kept on talking until midnight. Well, I won't do that. But it shows they had met on the first day of the week, and in that instance, they had communion. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2. Now, this is an instruction from the Apostle Paul. On the first day of the week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. Now, the question would be, if they were not meeting on the first day of the week, why would he tell them to save up their money and bring it with them on the first day of the week? Now that shows that the early Christians were already meeting on the first day of the week when our New Testament was written. Revelation chapter 1 verse 10. On the Lord's day, that's another way, that's probably the expression we use now. On the Lord's day, John writes, "I was in the Spirit and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet." So you can see the early Christians used to meet on the first day of the week. Now the seventh day, the Sabbath day, was to commemorate creation. It was a rest day. It says in 6 days God made or created the world and all that is in it, and he rested on the seventh day. But the first day of the week is resurrection day, and that is the day we remember that Jesus rose from the dead, to remember our redemption and why Christ came. Now sometimes you will read that the Lord did visit synagogues on the seventh day, the Sabbath day, and that's when he spoke there in the synagogues on a number of occasions. And Paul did likewise, because when you think about it, that's where the people were, and the Jewish people who still kept their Sabbath, that's where they attended, And that was a place where they were able to have ministry. Now, after a while, they weren't allowed in the synagogues anymore. But for the early Christians, they started to meet very early on the first day of the week. I read just this week of a man by the name of J. Vernon McGee tells the story of a man who wanted to have an argument about this, about the Sabbath day. And he was talking to another man and he said, "I'll give you $100 if you will show me where the Sabbath day has been changed." Ooh, that was a challenge, wasn't it? Well, this fellow, J. Vernon McGee, a Christian writer, says, "I don't think it has been changed." Stunned the fellow. He says, "Saturday is Saturday. It's the seventh day of the week, and it's the Sabbath day. I realise our calendar has been adjusted and might be a few days off, but we won't even consider that point. The seventh day is still Saturday, and it is still the Sabbath day." Well, this other man, who I presume would be a Seventh-day Adventist, he had a gleam in his eye. Aha! He's cornered him, he thought. "Then why don't you keep the Sabbath day if it hasn't been changed?" And this McGee answered, "Oh, the day hasn't been changed, but I have been changed," he said. "I've been given a new nature. I am now joined to Christ. I am part of the new creation. We celebrate the first day of the week because that is the day that Christ rose from the grave." And that's what it means when it says that all the ordinances Paul wrote in Colossians chapter 2, in fact I might look that verse up, Colossians chapter 2 and verse 14. Well, that's only one. There's a whole lot of verses we could use here. But Paul writes here, God, he says, "He forgave us all our sins, having cancelled the written code with its regulations that was against us and that stood opposed to us. And he took it away, nailing it to the cross." And in each of Paul's letters, he talks about the change that took place. For instance, here's one in Galatians. And he says there, Galatians chapter 3, verse 24, "So the law was put in charge to lead us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. Now that faith has come, we are no longer under the supervision of the Lord." And then you can go to the book of Ephesians, chapter 2, verse 14. "For he himself is our peace, who has made the two one, and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility." That's the barrier that he's talking about there, is between Jew and Gentile. And he says, how did he do this? "By abolishing in his flesh the law with its commandments and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new man out of the two." And there's many other verses that we could give, but what happened there when Christ died was a changing, a transition. The old written law had been fulfilled. It met its purpose, but now we're under a new law, the law of Christ. And you might remember that even way back in Exodus chapter 20, when the law was given, it was only given for Israel. Interestingly enough, did you know that? Now, I mean, it's good, it's God's principles, that doesn't alter. But it says there that this was for the Israelites as they came out of Egypt. It wasn't for any other nation. Now, it would have been good if other nations had kept those laws, because God brought them in. But they never heard of these laws. It was only for Israel. But then when Jesus came, a change took place. The old written law had been fulfilled. And there was a huge barrier between the Jews and the Gentiles. And what Jesus did, he broke down that barrier, and now they all became one. Jews and Gentiles still have to come exactly the same way to the cross to accept Jesus as their Saviour. So that's the teaching of the New Testament. We're not under the written law anymore. We're under the law of Jesus. And that applies to all Christians all over the world. Now, just before we go on to look at what the meaning of this passage is in Revelation 13, I'd just like to point out some important rules of interpretation. And these need to be kept in mind as you study particularly the book of Revelation. The first one is that the book of Revelation was written in a special kind of way, with a special kind of language, I suppose we could put it in that way. Now, how do we know this? Well, we're told in the very first verse. Unfortunately, most of the modern translations don't bring this out. But those of you who have an old King James Version, you will see it. Verse 1, Revelation 1, verse 1. And this is what it says. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him, to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. Now, most main translations would have the last part of that, and he sent and made it known, or something like that, to his by his angel to his servant John. But you notice the King James Version has the word signified. Now, I have a Greek New Testament, or a number of Greek New Testaments, and the word signified, that is the word in the original Greek language. But what does it mean? Now, if you looked it up in a dictionary, it means to represent or make known by the use of signs and symbols. In fact, the word signified itself, the first four letters, is the word sign. So it is written in a sign language with all kinds of symbols and signs, which means you don't take things literally. So when you read of a woman having seven heads and ten horns, you don't take that literally. Aren't you glad of that? Some of us said, I have enough trouble with a woman with one head. Imagine having a woman with seven heads. But that's just a symbol. We don't take those things literally. Years ago, one of our pastors, he had a little lad who was about seven or eight at the time, and he started having nightmares. Now, he was an avid reader, and so his parents thought it must be something that he'd written. And the little lad said, oh, well, I've been reading in the book of Revelation about all these beasts and dragons coming on the earth. Now, he had made the mistake, and after all, he was only seven or eight, but he had taken it just literally, like a lot of people do. But there in the first verse, we are told it is written in a sign language with a lot of symbols, and they represent things. Now, Jesus told a lot of stories that we don't take literally. They're just, and we call them parables. Now, for instance, the parable of the Good Samaritan. We don't sort of say, now the priest represents something and the Levite something else. They are just people in the story. The point of the story was answering the question, who is my neighbour? So Jesus just used these different characters in the story. That was incidental. They were just part of the story. We don't look for deeper hidden meaning. And in a sense, that's what we have to do with Revelation. We don't take it literally. It's written in a sign language. Now, give an example. My wife's parents were both born deaf and dumb. But they can communicate. They use what is called the deaf and dumb sign language. And that is the dictionary of it. And it's got all pictures of different things using your hands. Now, to most of us, we wouldn't have a clue what they're talking about, because it's all done with the hands. Now, when we were married, our wedding was rather unique, because we had a guy standing over here, and he was interpreting for her parents. I think everybody was paying more attention to them than the wedding ceremony. But the fellow that did our wedding also did the big Billy Graham crusades. And he used to stand over to the side. I remember this because I was in the choir. And there was about 300 or so deaf and dumb people. And there he was. And he was so quick. And he used to finish on average about 3 seconds after Billy. That's how quick he was. But there it is. It's all a sign language. All done with the hands. No voice, just hands. Now, actually, it changes. That's the Australian Sign Language, which is two hands. Now, in some programs, you'll see down the corner one using just one hand. That's the new language that they've developed now, more American. But that's a sign language. And that's how the book of Revelation is written, in a sign language. And it's meant for God's people to sort of look at the signs, and even though a lot of things were referring to what was happening when they lived, they had to remember that it's in a veiled way to sort of partly protect the Christians, really, because it's describing events and people of when they lived. But it's up to us to sort of try and understand what the signs are. Now, a lot of the signs and symbols are taken from the Old Testament. So to understand what they mean in the New Testament, we need to go back and look at where they were in the Old Testament. So that's the first point. The second one is, there is a unity of what Revelation is saying and the rest of the Bible. Now, so many interpretations ignore this rule, and a lot of Bible teachers have constructed a whole lot of things that's supposed to happen in the future, taking a lot of this literally, and you don't read of any of it anywhere in the rest of the Bible. Now, what we read of what Jesus taught about the future and his coming again, we also read in the book of Revelation. Now, the difference is, in the book of Revelation, it's all under signs and symbols and visions. But Jesus, and what Paul said, there's no signs and symbols. What you read is what will actually happen. But the book of Revelation is written in a symbolic way, so we need to understand the symbols. And then the third point I'll mention, we must always keep in mind that the book of Revelation was written for the first century Christians as well as us. So it must apply to their situation as well as us who live in the 21st century. Now that's important to keep in mind, because some interpretations have said, oh, the beast is Napoleon. In fact, one there where the beast is Adolf Hitler. But when you think about it, how much help and encouragement would it be to the first century Christians who are suffering persecution under the Emperor Nero and others if they knew that the beast was Adolf Hitler? What relevance would that have to them? Well, none at all. So you see that our interpretation really must cover a huge span of history, so that when we read, for instance, of some of the judgments coming on the world, and one of which is war, it's not just one particular war. Now, those living through World War I probably thought, well, this is the worst war we've ever had, and this is the one that it talks about in Revelation 6. Well, 20 years later, we had an even worse one called World War II. But what it's saying there is, it's just war in general, not one specific war. Just all wars, all earthquakes, not just one particular one. Now, we've had some shocking ones, and the big tsunami that took 250,000 people. But there's been a lot of others, when you delve back in history, that have killed a lot of people too. But so what it's saying is, it's not just looking at specific things, it's general. So that the first century Christians must be able to read this book and say, yes, that's what's happening in my world. Those of us who live in the 21st century say, yes, this is describing what's exactly happening in my world. So it applies to them as well as it applies to us. Now, if you read the whole of Revelation 13, there are two beasts mentioned. I didn't read the first one. But what does the symbol or the title beast mean? Is it a man? Is it a nation? Is it an empire or a world ruler? And this is where we start to look back into the Old Testament to help us understand. In Daniel chapter 7, he has a vision there of several beasts. And they represented, back in his day, anti-God empires and authorities and powers and nations and governments, or world empires, in particular two. Now, in Daniel's time, he lived during the power of two, the Babylonian and the Medes and the Persians. That was followed by the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great, which then was followed by the biggest and most powerful of all, the Roman Empire. Now all of these governments, or powers, or authorities, or world empires, when you look at their history, they were ruthless. They just stamped their authority, and there was just destruction on a huge scale, wholesale slaughter and killing by the thousands. They were anti-God. They had no time for God's rule or authority. They opposed God and God's people. They forced people to comply or obey upon sentence of death. So that's what these two beasts represented in Daniel's day. Now, that's the meaning of them here. So we take the Old Testament symbol and put it in the New Testament, and again, it represents anti-Christian, anti-God powers and authorities that are ruling our world. You know, it's interesting to look at some of the references here in Revelation. The first century Christians were forced to try and say, Caesar is Lord. Now, down through the centuries, there have been many numerous anti-God and anti-Christian leaders and governments and world powers that forced people to submit or be put to death. And I only have to mention Hitler and the Nazis, communism. These days, in our age, 2008, we look at militant Islam or the Hindus, have become very militant in recent years, and if you don't comply or you want to convert to Christianity, oh, that is bad. They will kill you or ostracize you. But interestingly enough, behind all these movements, of course, is Satan himself. And he's used under various classifications, or his name rather. In the book of Revelation chapter 20, there are four titles of Satan in one verse. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil, and Satan. Oh. So whenever you read of the devil, or rather the dragon, or the beast and his associates, you are reading of Satan's kingdom. Now remember, as we've seen in other occasions, there are two main kingdoms that Jesus taught and the Apostle Paul, the kingdom of light and the kingdom of darkness. God's kingdom, which Jesus established, that we saw last week, and Satan's kingdom. These two are diametrically opposed. One is built on love, the sacrifice of Jesus, and life. The other is built on darkness and evil and destruction and killing. They are totally opposite kingdoms. Now, when we come to the book of Revelation, they are still there, but they're used under different symbols and things. But that's what it's talking about. These two opposing kingdoms or forces that are against each other. But against Satan's, in Satan's kingdom, doesn't matter what guise it comes under. The world empires that were back in Daniel's day, or recent ones in our time. Hitler and the Nazis. Communism was right against Christianity and put a lot of Christians and pastors in prison. And then, of course, they seem to have gone off the scene. Satan's got another one now, using militant Islam and Hinduism. But behind it all, Satan's work. I bought an interesting book. Wouldn't exactly recommend you go out and buy this, but I like to check a lot of things out. Called The Nazis and the Occult. Now, interestingly enough, this is not written really from a Christian point of view. It's a secular book. But it's all there in the title, The Dark Forces Unleashed by the Third Reich. And it may surprise you to know that the Nazis were right in the occult. Now the occult is Satan's kingdom. The actual word means dark forces. That's the word meaning of occult. Now still around, but it is interesting to know that's what Satan, rather the Third Reich, was heavily involved in. One chapter is called Satan and the Swastika. Well, it's all there. And that's
what Satan did. He used that Nazi regime to try and bring in darkness and kill millions. That's what he's all about. And that was actually the first beast, if we had time to study that. The first beast in Revelation 13 uses violent measures to oppose Christians. The second beast is a bit different. It uses religious means, and it religiously deceives people. And this is where we get into the chapter itself, chapter 13. And you notice some of the references there. Verse 13. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Does that ring a bell? Was there somebody in the Old Testament that did that? Indeed there was. Elijah. He called fire to come down from heaven in full view of men. And it must have been spectacular. Imagine that. When he built the altar of rock, and all of a sudden he prayed to God, and fire came down and consumed the rock. Boy, what sort of fire is that? But now we have this Satan emissary, or false prophet. He's doing the same. And it's saying that Satan is out to deceive people, and he will even do miraculous signs and wonders. Now, do we read that anywhere else? Did Paul or Jesus talk about that? Well, they both of them talked about false prophets. But listen to what the Apostle Paul warned people about. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. Well, that's quite amazing. Even got the word deceive there, as it has in the book of Revelation. Same word, deceive. Now, did Paul or anybody else talk about that? About Satan trying to deceive the world? Well, listen to this. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. That's Paul writing in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, listen to this. Paul writes, I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, that your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. Eve was deceived and then fell into sin. And ever since, that's been probably the main way Satan works. He deceives nations and people. And that's one of the key words, actually, in the book of Revelation. Deception or deceiving. That's the way Satan works. And he will use people and enable them to do all kinds of, as Paul says, counterfeit miracles, signs and wonders to deceive people. And you will hear of certain faith healers and people being able to do miracles. Be very careful what you accept, because these can be, on the appearance, might you think, oh, my, isn't that wonderful? God's working here. Is it God or is it Satan? Remember, Satan is or can disguise himself as an angel of light. Oh, that's hard to pick, isn't it? If he can do that, what about all his followers, evil spirits, and the way they deceive people? Well, getting back to Revelation 13, we'll read on there. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. Now, that's interesting. That is saying it's a worldwide deception. It's not localized to one nation or one country or one person or one period of time. This is a worldwide deception going on here. And Satan operates worldwide. He doesn't keep his activities just to restrict himself to one country. He works all around the world. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, notice the reference in Revelation 13, verse 14, the next verse. He deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honour of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He ordered them to set up an image in honour of the beast. Where did that happen before in the Old Testament? Again, yes it did. Nebuchadnezzar did that. Remember, he built a great image? And then he said, I want everyone at the sound of all the different instruments to fall down and worship. If you don't, you'll be thrown into the furnace of fire. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego refused. And of course, we know the story. So isn't it interesting? There's the Old Testament reference there coming out. And all through history, Satan has used people and evil governments to try and force people to worship some image. Isn't it interesting that a lot of these dictators all have their portraits in huge, big pictures plastered all over the place? We saw that with Saddam Hussein. We saw that with whopping big pictures of Hitler when he was around. And now, of course, this Robert Mugabe does the same. They love to have their big picture in huge, big portraits splattered all over the place. That's really man worship. And that's what Satan wants. He doesn't care who the man is, as long as you're worshipping, which of course takes worship away from God. So there's the forerunner. Happened way back in Daniel's time, and it's been happening ever since. Christians were forced to say, everybody was forced to say, Caesar is Lord. But no real Christian could ever say that. Only Jesus is Lord. And so we see this same worship of man mentioned in Romans chapter 1. Interestingly enough, Paul writing there. Now this is not under any symbols or signs. This is just straight what it is. And Paul writes, For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. There it is again. The opposite to light, of course, is darkness. The opposite to the kingdom of light is the kingdom of darkness. And it says, although they claimed to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man, birds and animals and reptiles. That's what man does. He worships created things and he worships himself. Now we come to the actual mark. What is it? Well, it's not a literal mark. You don't get stamped with 666 on your forehead. It's not meant to be taken like that. It's just a symbol. Now, we actually brand cattle. Well, when I was working on a farm, we used to do the sheep. And we used to brand them all so we knew who was our sheep. Now that's just a mark of identification. And that's what the symbol here is meaning. It's those who have this mark, which is not a literal one, but it's saying they are identified with Satan's kingdom, the kingdom of darkness. Those who serve the beast, this anti-God, anti-Christian world empire. But notice it says there in our reading back in Revelation 13, it says, He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refuse to worship the image to be killed. That's what happened in Daniel's day. Those who refused to bow down and worship were put to death. And Christians even now who refuse to submit to an anti-Christian government that's trying to force people to do certain things, what happens? Well, they get put in prison or killed. And notice it says he forced everyone. That's the way Satan works. He doesn't offer or he doesn't invite people to serve him. He forces them. Now that's so different to the way the Lord Jesus operates. Jesus simply said, come and follow me. He doesn't force people. He invites them. So you can see there that we have this mark of the beast, and we must remember that not only cattle But slaves were also branded or marked back in those days. They used to put them up against the door and bang a great big hole through their earlobe here. And that meant they were a slave for life to that particular owner. That was the mark of ownership. Now, the mark meant that the slave belonged to their master. But very soon the expression to receive the mark of someone began to mean to belong to that person or someone, to serve them, and even to worship them. And so here, receiving the mark of the beast means worshipping the beast. You belong to him. That's, of course, Satan's realm, Satan's kingdom. So receiving the mark of the beast means belonging to the beast and worshipping him. Now, the mark of the beast, of course, is the God opposing, Christ rejecting, Christ persecuting spirit of Satan's kingdom that is operating all over the world and operating all the time. It never takes a holiday. It's continually operating. Now, this mark is impressed on the forehead or the right hand. Now, that indicates something. What does our be behind our forehead? Well, it's our mind. And Satan knows that if he can get the mind of people, he's got them. And that's why it says, the God of this world has blinded the minds of people. They can't see the truth. Otherwise, they get right with God straight away. So that's what the forehead symbolizes. The right hand indicates that's what we work with. That's what we do things. That's action. We work with our hands. So that indicates action and industry and working. And so that's how Satan operates. And these little symbols represent that the forehead is your mind. And Satan wants to get control of the mind. He also wants to get control of people's actions. That's why it refers to the hand. So the mark of the beast symbolizes that an unbeliever who persists in their wickedness belongs to the beast and therefore to Satan himself, whom they worship. Now, that's different to the Christian. We're not stamped with that mark. We are stamped with a seal. Paul talks about that in the book of Ephesians. He says, you were sealed to the day of redemption. But if we read on from Revelation 13 into the very next chapter, we read this. Then I looked, verse 1, and there before me was the Lamb, standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a sound from heaven like the roar of a rushing waters and like the loud peal of thunder. The sound I heard was like that of harpists playing their harps, and they sang a new song. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they kept themselves pure. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They were purchased from among men and offered as firstfruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. Now that is a description, of course, of God's people. Now it says 144,000. But you're thinking, surely there's more than 144,000 Christians. Yes, there is. That's just a symbol. That's sort of a perfect 12 by 12. And it's a symbol of all God's chosen people, those who follow him. And that's the description. They sang a new song. Now, I know each one of the cults actually claim that they are the 144,000 Jehovah's Witnesses do and the Mormons do. But it's just a symbol of God's people. And of course, there's far more Christians than that. Even some of the great revivals, the Welsh revival, they had more people become Christians in about a year than that figure, in 1 year alone. So there's a lot more than that. It's just a symbolic number for God's chosen people. But notice it says they had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. Now, that is not a literal name. I know some Christians like to wear a little lapel or a necklace or something with a cross. But we're not given a literal name there. But I hope people know that we serve the name of the Lord Jesus. And it's just a symbol. But it represents our standing with God.
we have the name of the Lord Jesus on our heart and on our mind. And that's where we have a mark. I have a little book called The Mark of a Christian. Now what is it? Not a literal mark. But Jesus said, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples. That's right, if you have love. That is the mark of a Christian, not a literal mark. It's a characteristic of where people know that we are one of the Lord's. They know it by the love we have for each other. I'll just finish this. And I must apologise, I've had to leave about half of it out. But you'll be glad of that. But listen to this great line from one of Charles Wesley's hymns. And it's hymn number 297. We're not actually singing this, but I love that this line came to me yesterday. It's the last verse. And he says, your nature, gracious Lord, impart, come quickly from above, write your new name upon my heart, your new best name of love. Pardon? 297, oh for a heart to praise my God. And there he sums it up. That's the name that we have, the name of the Lord, which is the name of love. That is the name that should be implanted on our heart. Well, I think you don't have to worry, getting back to the little leaflet that we had in the beginning. You haven't got the mark of the beast. You won't get tattooed here one day with 666. That's the number of man. And if you look at the history of man, what is it? Well, in summary, violence, death, war, just goes on and on. You look at Noah, Sodom, Gomorrah, when Jonah went to Nineveh. It's just the history of man. That's what it is. And that's why Jesus came. Because he knew what man's heart was like, and he wanted to change it. And that's what Wesley sings about. Oh, for a heart that's been changed. And that's the heart that we want. A heart that's pure and clean and white. And a name that's stamped upon our forehead, what's that? The name of the Lord Jesus. And that's whom we serve.